Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
The past few years have been years of firsts for me. For example, first credit card in my name, not yours. First vehicle purchased with legal funds. First time in my life living on the legal side of things. And the first time in my life I've faced and discussed how my mother abused me and my sister. Now, I started speaking by promising myself I was going to try to learn more about who I was and why I did the things I did. That idea started small, on stages speaking to audiences, with me working to add some new truth to each presentation, some new insight about who I was with each new idea or topic I discussed. Now, that has grown to me basically becoming the criminal equivalent of a recovering Alcoholics Anonymous member. I've been following the 12 steps, and let me tell you, that shit works. I never thought it would, but it damn sure does. And just like an alcoholic, I don't say I'm reformed. I'm recovering. I know my triggers. I know what it would take for me to go back to being a criminal. I've worked hard to make sure those triggers are avoided and to have a support network in place to make sure if those triggers do appear or if I'm tempted with anything, that I have that support network that I can rely upon. And I'm lucky. I'm damn lucky. I'm telling you this because all of that led to the first season of the Anglerfish podcast that you're listening to. Carice Hendrick and I launched the online fraudcast. It was designed to speak to merchants about the types of fraud they might encounter and how to avoid those types of fraud. Online fraudcast was a success, and we had an amazing first season. Anglerfish came on because of the success of the online fraudcast and also the way I was going about finding out who I was and why I ticked. I know now the most important thing I can do for myself is to find out who I am. My agent, Josh Cohen, suggested I do a podcast telling my story. I liked the idea. I said yes. The idea I had was to take a road trip, sit down with some of the top minds in the United States to discuss the major segments of my life, my childhood, my cybercrime years, my work with law enforcement, prison, and finally, redemption. I would sit down with former federal prosecutor Thomas O'Malley, former FBI agent Aaron Sherman, filmmaker and DePaul professor Kelly Pope, Identity Theft Council president and cybersecurity advocate Neil O'Farrell, and others. I figured that first season of Anglerfish would maybe be 18 episodes, and then I could launch season 2 and use Anglerfish to examine those darkest corners of our online lives. I made a road trip out of the interviews, driving across the United States, seeing all the sights along the way as I sat down with some of the best people in the United States to discuss my story. It turns out, though, it wasn't enough. Even though I was recording hours of interviews, there was still much of the story being left out. So I changed the format of Anglerfish just weeks before its launch. The overall story would be told by sitting down with my next-door neighbor, Ken Allen, a truly good gentleman, head of our neighborhood watch, blogger, podcaster, and former radio show host, among many other things. Then we would use the road trip interviews as a kind of highlights version of the segments we were discussing. This episode brings in the outstanding Aaron Sherman to discuss that segment of my life where I work with the United States Secret Service and where I screw them over. Aaron is former FBI and is now Senior Director of Cyber Threat Intelligence at Braintrace. Braintrace is outstanding in the work they do, and Aaron is truly one of the best human beings I have ever met. Not only that, but he is also one of the best in cybersecurity and in combating online threats that I have ever seen. You know, it took me over 40 years to realize there are people on this planet who simply want to do the right thing. For years, that idea was foreign to me. I thought there was nothing more important than money. Aaron and people like him have been chief in showing me a different, much more rewarding way of life. Aaron works daily to make the world a better place. He sacrifices to help those who are in need. He is someone I look up to and I respect greatly. I am honored that he agreed to sit down with me. Welcome to the Anglerfish Podcast, where we visit the darkest corners of our online lives. I'm your host, Brett Johnson. The United States Secret Service called me the original Internet Godfather. Now, what does it take to get a title like that? 39 felonies, a place on the United States Most Wanted list, an escape from prison, and I built the first organized cybercrime community, Shadow Crew. Shadow Crew was a precursor to today's darknet and darknet markets, and it laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels still operate today. This first season of the Anglerfish Podcast tells of my rise and fall as the world's first internet godfather. It's a fascinating story. You'll learn how cybercriminals think, how modern cybercrime came into being, and why it's so successful and hard to stop, and how I was able to turn from a life of crime to one of using the knowledge I acquired as a criminal to help protect others against the type of person I used to be.
My name's Aaron Sherman. Thanks for having me with you, Brett. So yeah, I'm here at Braintrace in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's our headquarters. We're cybersecurity company.
And an outstanding company too.
Yeah. We're just on the SOC floor right now. We have our 24/7 365 security operations center where we do cybersecurity for tons of companies.
You showed that to me earlier today and I am extremely impressed. I mean, I wish I had something like that at home.
Me too.
So now you told me, so you didn't mention that just now, but you said at one point you were the only agent that spoke Pashto in the entire bureau.
Right, yeah. So before I joined the FBI, I was in the Army, and right. I learned a couple languages, Arabic and Pashto. People go, okay, Arabic, but what's Pashto? I'm like, well, and my explanation was, well, that's what the Taliban speaks. And they're like,
good explanation.
Oh, okay. So Pashto spoken in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, mostly in the area in between the two countries.
Right. So you spent a lot of time over there.
Spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. Funny thing is when I was in the Army, I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, and I had a couple of kids, and my wife was like, you need to stop going to Afghanistan. But I loved what I was doing. I was in intelligence. I was a counterintelligence agent. So doing some pretty cool stuff. And I'm like, man, I wish I could still do that, but not go to Afghanistan if I could do that every day. So I decided the FBI. Domestic agency. I can do all my secret squirrel stuff.
Absolutely.
And go home every night. So I joined up and I told them I spoke Pashto and they're like, all right, you're in. Because nothing else would merit my ability to be able to join the FBI. And then so I joined the FBI and it's fun because you don't know what you're getting yourself into.
Right.
So you join as a special agent and they don't tell you where you're going to go or what you're going
to
do.
So where'd you go to first?
Well, so I was in the FBI Academy.
Okay.
And at week 7 is called Orders Night. So orders night is where you go into this room and they have a big map on, and everyone has a pen and an envelope saying where they're going to go.
Oh, geez.
The joke is in the FBI, there's the person who decides where agents are going to be assigned to is a drunk monkey in the basement of the FBI building who has a big map and a dartboard. And so the drunk monkey takes Aaron Sherman's dart and just throws it at the wall. And wherever it lands, that's where you're going to be assigned.
Okay.
However, in my case, I figured, all right, I speak Pashto in Arabic, counterintelligence. I'm going to go to like El Paso or Anchorage, Alaska or something like the Minot, North Dakota. But I guess the drunk monkey was a little sober that day when he picked me. And he said, okay, no, Aaron Sherman, you're going to go to Washington field office. And to be do counterterrorism.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, all right, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I showed up. I was on an Afghanistan-Pakistan extraterritorial squad.
Oh, geez.
Which means I thought like E.T., like E.T. phone home, but no, it means outside of the United States. I'm like, oh, and I realized I was on a squad that goes to Afghanistan.
So your wife tells you it's time to come home, yeah. And you're heading right back out.
Yeah, but it was completely different. Almost night and day from being like an Army guy to an FBI agent in Afghanistan. So I didn't have to spend as much time, but I did go a number of times and did some pretty interesting things. And by virtue of speaking Pashto, I had a lot of opportunities over there. Did some pretty cool things.
So you went from D.C. and came straight to Salt Lake City or not?
Yeah, so I was in D.C. and in the FBI, it's very difficult to move around.
Right.
But I made this deal with a good friend of mine who was on a cyber squad. And I always wanted to do cyber. So backing up a little bit, when I was in high school, my dad had gotten out of the Air Force. And we retired and we were in the middle of nowhere, Michigan, cornfields and pickup trucks. and my dad was trying to find a job and he couldn't find one, but he ended up finding one at a Radio Shack.
Okay.
And that's where my life turned.
Where you just build everything yourself.
Yes. So after school, I'd go to Radio Shack and sit in the back and build things.
Oh man, that'd be life right there. I would have loved that.
Yeah, so like my childhood hero was Kevin Mitnick.
Of
and
course.
Emmanuel
Why
Goldstein
not?
And Captain Crunch and all of those guys. And so I was in the back building those boxes, like blue box, black box, beige boxes, playing with the telephone lines. I ended up getting into serious trouble for my phone activities.
So what'd you do?
I'm pretty sure I've disclosed this already to the proper authorities, but I was like 13, 14 years old at the time. In Michigan, country where you have the big square blocks of like mile by mile, square mile blocks.
Right.
And on those blocks, you probably have maybe 5-6 neighbors who are in that block. Well, I lived at the corner where the telephone junction box was at.
Okay.
So all their telephone lines had to go past my house first, and then they would daisy chain off going around to the other ones. So I realized that from my house to the junction box, there were a bunch of already non-used lines.
Oh,
so I just spliced into every single one of them and then ran them up to my room, and I had an operator switchboard that I made and hooked it up to my stereo. It was fantastic. It was very cool.
So how long did it take you to do that?
I don't remember, you know, just trying to figure it out. I mean, that's how it was. There was
but
no manual.
But you're 13, 14 doing this.
Yeah. It was interesting. So telephones was a big thing. I got in trouble at high school a lot for playing with the telephones and the PA systems and doing some fun things. And then it evolved into computers, and I had my own bulletin board system with my own hacker buddies with my 14.4 baud modem.
Right.
And I thought I was like really cool. Obviously, no girlfriends, right? But you know, that's the trade-off.
Well, that's changed now.
Yeah.
Now they get
all
the girlfriends.
So now, and then I was doing some more and more, and I got into, hacked into a university's network.
That's true.
Yeah, and then I got arrested.
Right.
And the FBI knows about it. Everybody knows about that. So that's out in the open. But I got arrested, and then I realized, like, I don't want to get in trouble anymore. But there just wasn't the outlet, right?
So unlike me, you knew when to stop.
Well, I guess. I mean, my parents scared me to death, and being arrested was scary. But then fast forward to when I was in the FBI, I was able to switch spots with my buddy who was on the cyber squad.
Ah, right.
And so he wanted to go to Afghanistan and fly in helicopters and save the day. And so we just switched places. And then I was in a cyber squad, and that was fantastic. And I was able to, I was in a squad that investigated primarily nation state actors. So like China, Russia, hacking into clear defense contractors in DC area. It was a huge problem. But I thought it was fantastic. I was able to get back to my roots.
Yeah.
I was able to leverage a lot of the investigative techniques that I learned as a counterterrorism agent. But now with this spin on cyber, and it was just like, all right, let's do this. But secretly in the back of my head, I always committed to myself, if I ever found that 14-year-old Aaron Sherman and he was in trouble for hacking, I would understand where he was coming from.
Okay.
And I would help him.
Well, you know, I've got to ask, did you find him?
No.
No.
No, I didn't.
Did you find anybody close to him or not?
No, most of the people that I investigated needed to go to jail.
Yeah, my associates needed to go to jail too.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean,
But I know I continue, even now that I'm out of the FBI and I'm on the private side doing things, I find kids who are interested in cybersecurity, and I can tell, like, oh, you dabble on the dark side a little bit.
Right.
So we just help mentor them. There's a lot of great skills. These kids are brilliant.
There are.
And so it's just a matter of, now I feel like I got to be a good mentor and help.
That's one of the things that I'm asked at conferences, and I was even asked at Quantico a few months back, because I make this statement. I believe that if you're an adult and you break the law, that you need to do some prison time.
Yeah.
but if you're a minor, I don't think a minor should be sent to prison. I think a minor just needs, as you said, some mentoring, someone to take them under their wing and give them a chance, you know, guide them.
Yeah,
I think that's very admirable that you do that. I really do, because I've seen some people, and most of them aren't like that, but I've seen some people that think that everyone should go to prison, and I just don't agree with that.
Yeah.
I think that you can turn some, you know, especially the kids, I think you can turn them around and give them a chance.
Yeah.
So you're at Braintrace now.
Yep, I'm at Braintrace. I'm the Senior Director of Cyber Threat Intelligence. It's the longest title
I've
ever had.
I love that title.
I'm doing some really cool things here. I'm relying a lot on the information and experience that I gained in the FBI and even in the Army too.
Sure.
On bad guys and how they operate, and the FBI, like how these cyber criminals are organized, how they work, the shared criminal network that you talk a lot about.
Right.
A lot of fun Nigerian crimes is very interesting. And I take that knowledge and I take these problem sets and I this is what the bad guys are doing. And I could see their side of the fence. And I'm on the other side of the fence where I'm in corporate America seeing what the defenders are faced with every day.
Right.
And I have a pretty unique ability or position where I could see both of those. I'm like, okay, I know exactly what we need to do to fix this. And so
Absolutely.
That's what we're doing. We're building some pretty cool things.
Beautiful.
And to help prevent one of the biggest crimes right now is business email compromise.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted everyone to know. As far as I'm concerned, I say it all the time to anyone that will listen to me, that you are the authority on business email compromise. I mean, I don't know anyone that is more well-versed on this planet than Aaron Sherman is on BEC.
Oh, I don't know about that. But
I do.
There's a lot of people who are doing some pretty good stuff against business email compromise. So,
So now that being said, what type of trends do you see coming up in the future? Business email compromise persists.
Yo, it's going to, in 2017, the IC3 report that the FBI put out, business email compromise was at an annual loss of, I think it was like around $600 million of loss. And then the next year for 2018, it was $1.2 billion of loss.
So it's not going anywhere.
Oh, no way.
Right.
And this is the reason why. The reason why is it doesn't matter how smart our tools get. I mean, technology is evolving and we're getting smarter and smarter. BEC is it's social engineering scam.
That's it.
It's a low-tech scam leveraging email, and what it's exploiting is this implied trust.
Right.
In communications that you already have with people. So via email, phone, SMS messages. And so there's a number of different approaches, but it has to be a later approach. And so that's what we're working here on Braintrace. But I think it's going to keep getting big until we can start changing industry minds.
So I do want to mention one more thing before we get into the meat of the podcast. But you were telling me, I came in today, and you were telling me about this human trafficking project and this work that you're doing. And I would love for you to walk the audience through, especially this Las Vegas story. I mean, you were... I'll let you tell it. I don't want to. It's just it left me absolutely floored. The type of work that you're doing right now with that.
Yeah. So as you know, human trafficking is a kind of a hot topic now.
Yeah.
And it's a big problem. And I think traditionally, a lot of people in the United States have assumed, you know, when they hear human trafficking, they think the big van comes up and steals kids and drives off and puts them in human trafficking. And that's not necessarily the case. Or they just assume that only happens in foreign countries, which that is also true. It doesn't really happen here. Or it doesn't happen in small town USA. But in fact, it does. It does. It's that mentality, like, not in my town, or it doesn't happen here, is what kind of keeps the problem expanding and growing, right? So how did I got started in human trafficking just through some groups that I did some work with on a cyber side, more cyber investigations. That's what I mean, if you ask me what my passion is, It's more as an investigator, right? I still have that investigator. I want to know the truth. And one of the best tools are all these cyber tricks and wizardry that I could use to be able to get some really good information. So I was asked by a couple of groups to do some things for them, and it worked out great. And then they are involved full time in human trafficking. And what they do, they just go around the country looking for these kids who are missing, and they have really great intelligence capabilities, and they do some great things. So,
and you know, you were, I'll let you continue in a second, but I just want to point out, you were telling me about this one girl that you saved that has actually dropped out completely of prostitution and everything. And what got me so bad is you told me she was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, Aaron, when you said that, my initial thought was, how long had she been involved in it before you found her?
Yeah, her story is fairly interesting. She grew up on the West Coast, and she obviously had a bad home life. That's the trend that we see in girls getting involved with this. So she had a bad home life, and then she had an older boyfriend who came into her life who was providing her with kind of the attention or love that she was lacking in her home life, right? And then so she gravitated towards that and then hooked up with this guy. And then he, you know, took her out of that situation. So she thought she was good and then ended up on the East Coast and then realized that he was a bad guy.
Jeez.
And forced her into prostitution. And so her options were leave this guy and go back home or stay. She just didn't have any options. And that's... Right. That's really the problem with human trafficking. Every person that we see, with the exception of a few people who were legitimately taken by force, right? These vulnerable individuals, I'll call them, just didn't, and it all comes down to they didn't have love growing up.
Sure.
They weren't taken care of. They weren't valued.
So there's no real, so you're left with two horrible decisions.
Yeah,
go back in the environment you were in or keep doing what you were doing.
Yeah, and so when we get in front of these individuals and we say, hey, you now have an option to get out of this, they can't comprehend it. It's actually really sad when you sit down with them, like, you could go back and live in the same life you're gonna live, and the life expectancy is actually pretty low for that. Or you can get out, let us help you. We could send you wherever you want. There's lots of organizations that do some great work with these people, and they put them through school, they give them a place to live, they help them get back on their feet, but they don't see that as an option because it never was. And so sometimes it's hard.
So how many, I guess it's going to be a sad question to ask, but when you know, out of every 100 that's saved, how many will actually end up going right back to prostitution or you know, back what they were doing?
I'm not exactly sure. However, from my personal experience, I think the majority of them kind of do go back. One, because when groups go in and help them get out of that situation temporarily, the solution is temporary.
Right.
Or the state or the government resources available to that person once they get out is next to nothing. When we were doing that search, which I'll talk about here in a second, we were in the state of Nevada, and there were some like social workers that were engaged in trying to help these girls, but at the same time, they didn't have any options for them. They didn't have a place where they can go stay. So one of the girls was picked up by a social worker, and we intercepted and we were talking, and the girl didn't want to come with us or want help. And so the social worker had no choice and had to drive her right back to the drug house she was picked up at. And the social worker knew 100% that she was dropping off that minor back at that drug house where she was going to be put back on the streets that night.
Oh, dear.
There's just no option.
Just because there's no infrastructure at all to get these girls out of this type of thing.
Yeah. But I think that's changing. Just the other day, I was reading in Salt Lake City here, I think it was maybe just yesterday, all the governors from the United States came and had a big governor's conference here in Salt Lake. And their number one topic was human trafficking, addressing the problem, the initial causes, and how to put in some infrastructure to help prevent it. But then also actually addressing the problem, and when you get girls out, allocating funds for government resources, for law enforcement, and for private groups to come in and provide those options. So you don't have to put them back in the drug house.
So is at least... at least is law enforcement pretty good about prosecuting the pimps and the people who are trafficking in these girls or not?
I think it depends, right? It's kind of, trafficking is kind of a difficult crime to prosecute because there's a lot of different elements that you need to satisfy when you're trying to charge that crime. There's been some successes, but I think, and it might be a perception that it is difficult. I'm not quite sure. I've never actually investigated a human trafficking case. But I do know that a lot of times when private groups come in and they start doing operations to identify and rescue and then help these girls out, law enforcement will be there to support. But as far as prosecuting these cases, I think it's kind of difficult. But there are some groups out there that's their sole purpose, is they go in and they do a lot of the investigative work and they put together these pretty much sealed tight cases and hand deliver them to the police and say, hey, here's a case, take this information, and then you can vet it all out. And it's pretty much a closed case. So pretty good.
It's good to see
this.
I mean, hats off to you. I mean, I want you to talk about the surveillance thing because you told me this story. It blew my mind. And it just talks to me. I mean, since I've met you, Aaron, you are one of these top-notch guys. I wish, honestly, I wish I would have led the type of life that you've led. Not doing the cool stuff, but just the way that you concentrate on trying to help people.
Well, I look at you, and I see how you're helping people. So that keeps me going.
It took a while for me to get here.
You're like a fine wine, Brett. Right? You only get better with age. So you're doing a good job.
So anyway, the surveillance on the house.
Right. So it's every year. It's called the Big Search, and it's correlation with the Super Bowl, which traditionally has high rates of sex trafficking because it brings an influx of people. This year we decided, even though the Super Bowl was somewhere else, I don't know where it was.
Yeah, I don't even know where it was.
Atlanta,
either.
Maybe?
Not a clue.
Somewhere?
It was Atlanta. Absolutely. That's where it was.
Okay. We decided to focus on Nevada, on Las Vegas, because people still go and watch it there without having to go.
A lot of gambling parties,
right? Sure. So we decided to do it in Vegas, and I'm not taking any credit for this at all. I was just a participant in this, but there's a lot of groups that spent a lot of time preparing for it and putting together and working together with law enforcement and the state of Nevada to do this. So no credit at all, but I got to participate and help out. And part of the reason why I enjoy doing that is because I could bring with me my bag of cyber tricks.
And you do have quite the bag.
Yeah. So a lot of times some of these people are just using kind of not gumshoe tactics, but just kind of street smarts and interviewing and surveillance. And then I was able to bring with me my Wi-Fi pineapple and a few other kind of tips and tricks to be able to electronically identify and geolocate pimps. And
so for anyone that's not tech savvy, why don't you tell everyone what a Wi-Fi pineapple is?
Oh, what isn't the Wi-Fi pineapple? Just Google Wi-Fi pineapple and you'll figure it out. But essentially, it's a cool little tool. It looks kind of like a Wi-Fi router, and then you could really do anything with it. You could pretend to be an internet access point, so people log into you and think they're using you can name it free Starbucks Wi-Fi.
It's pretty effective.
And people will go and try and go do the internet stuff in it, and you can watch their traffic. Yeah, and you can scan for devices. You could do passive or active mode. It's a pretty cool tool. But that was really helpful in Las Vegas during this because we were able to track some of these people and geolocate them. So we found this house. And actually, this is the house that the social worker dropped off that girl in front of. Right.
So that's the house.
Yep. So that's the house. And this house was pretty interesting. It was two story. The bottom stories they sold drugs out of, and then top story they sold the girls out of.
And so two story double business.
Yep. Yeah.
Upstairs trafficking, downstairs drugs.
Yep. And there was this house. We knew there were other girls in there. We just had to get eyes on and see what the situation was to see if we needed to engage law enforcement or try to get these girls out. The problem was it was in such a bad part of town that the law enforcement told us not even to go near it.
So law enforcement says, don't even try it.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm looking at you, and you would stick out. Without a doubt.
Yep.
You're the most clean-cut individual on the planet. You're going to stick out like a sore thumb in a neighborhood like that.
Yeah, Google Aaron Sherman, and you'll see. He's right. So the problem was, and we were just driving around, and they in the centers where they have the drug houses, and it's just open fields, and then they have guys on bikes as spotters, and so can't even get close enough, right?
Right.
So we tried and we were failing, we weren't getting close enough, but I did notice as we were driving around, there was a lot of transient folks, there were homeless people walking around, stumbling around. And so I thought, those guys can just walk right past the house without even a second notice.
Sure.
I told my guys, hey, drop me off. And so they dropped me off. I had my phone. I had a couple other things to help protect me and my pineapple. And then I found some dirty clothes crumped up in the corner that had been used for hygiene purposes. So
you found some really soiled clothes.
Yeah, some really soiled clothes. And I put them on. And it tell you what, even though it smelt the part, it looked the part. And so it was good. I didn't need to take a shower when I was done. But
so how long were you out there?
2 days.
2 days. So you were 2 days dressed in these clothes.
Yeah.
Outside of the house.
Yep. Stumbling around. I actually found a shopping cart full of stuff and I was pushing that around. I felt
questioned anything at all.
No. But it was great. I was able to get in front of the house and kind of camp out and just, you know, I got my sitting on my piece of cardboard out there. They didn't even question anything. And then I was able to radio back to the teams that were kind of further out as close as they could get and just tell them, hey, here's cars coming in, cars coming out, girls leaving, girls coming. And they were able to, based off that information, go and interdict maybe 3 or 4 girls.
Okay.
And then one of those girls is the girl who was able to actually get out. And
that's amazing she was able to get out. It really is.
Yeah. But a lot of great work. I wish if I could do that full time. Right?
Well, I want to tell you that. You know, I see what you do with stuff like that. And then this other stuff, you've got tons of stories. And you know, I've seen you do this type of work before. And it floors me. I mean, it seriously does. It floors me that you do this. And I'm thankful we have people like you in this world. I really am.
Well, there's a lot more of us than I think that people realize. There's a lot of people out there doing good.
You're this great security guy now. You do a lot of great work and everything else that we could have a discussion about that. I could, you know, basically tell you my story of what happened, and you could call me out on any BS that I might try to put forth or anything else like that.
I'm ready.
You're
for
ready,
it.
Huh?
Yep.
Well, as you know, I made the Shadow Crew made the front cover of Forbes in August of 2004. And I think that what happened was I knew it happened. I had retired from Shadow Crew because I was scared of law enforcement coming down and arresting everyone. So I had stepped away from Shadow Crew. So when I found out about it was when I went to Barnes & Noble, and there was Forbes. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting article. And I'm starting to read the article. And of course, it starts talking about Shadow Crew and all the identity theft and everything. So of course, I go back on the forum, the Shadow Crew forum, and I'm reading the reactions. And of course, the reactions initially were of rejoice. You know, everyone was there. We made it. We made it. We made it. And then within a few hours, it was like, this could not be good. And sure enough, it was not good, because a few months later, October 26th, Secret Service arrested 33 people in 6 countries in 6 hours. And they shut down the site, and they have that. You can still Google the site the way it looked when they shut it down. It's got a picture of a guy in jail saying, you are no longer safe in the shadows. So that was the thing. And of course, I was picked up February 8th of 2005. And what happened was I had met this girl. My wife had left me, and I started dating this stripper, fell in love with her, went through all of my money, and Shadow Crew gets busted. Tax season is over, because that's where most of my money was coming from, was tax fraud. So I didn't have any avenue to steal any more money. So what I did is I started running counterfeit cashier's checks to try to get enough money to survive until tax season started back. So I'm running counterfeit cashier's checks. My girlfriend, fiance at that point, she wanted Tiffany rings, so I'm stealing Tiffany rings with counterfeit cashier's checks. And that's how I got picked up. I was picking up a set of Tiffany, not engagement rings, but wedding bands at a drop address. I waited there for, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours. And Elizabeth, that was her name, she didn't know what I was doing for a living. She thought I was a fraud consultant. That's what I told everyone. Fraud consultant. That was my joke. I just didn't tell them which side of the fraud equation I was on. So it was a funny for me. But I'm there for 4 or 5 hours waiting. UPS truck pulls up. I get out of the car, meet the driver at the truck. Hey, you got a package for me, don't you? He's like, yeah, you got a driver's license? So I show him a driver's license, hand him a counterfeit cashier's check. He hands me the package. I turn around, and there is the Charleston County Police Department and the FBI. The agent's name was Cynthia McCants. They arrested me right there. And it turns out in the parking lot in the area, I don't know, 30 people, 30 law enforcement officers there during that entire time. I didn't notice any of them. But yeah, that was me, man. That was me. So they Back then, they didn't have an interview facility for, you know, cyber criminals. So they took me to the drug place where they interview all the druggies. Cynthia McCants is sitting across from me at a table. She opens up a folder, slides a photograph or a photocopy of a fake driver's license I'd used, I guess, about a year earlier. Slides it across the table, looks at me and says, "Does that look familiar?" And I told her, "Yeah, but it's a heavier version of me." As soon as I said that, two Secret Service agents walk in, sit down across from me and look at me and say, "We would like to talk to you about some counterfeit credit cards." And I knew right there that I was in a lot of trouble. What happened from there is they wanted to search the house. Elizabeth, I guess she didn't know at that point I'd been arrested. She didn't even know what I was doing for a living. I agreed to let them search the house as long as I could go with them. So I was gone by this point. I left that morning at 9 a.m. We arrived back at the house at 8 or 9 that night. So I'd been gone for 11 or 12 hours. It was a month before I started work for the Secret Service. I was in Charleston. Elizabeth lets me move in with her. So I'm there. Two Secret Service agents, they come down to talk about the investigation, the way it's going to work and everything. And they start asking me questions on ideas that I might have on how to catch criminals. And I guess that's where I started kind of figuring out that, okay, they don't have as good a grasp on a lot of this stuff that I thought they did at that point. Turns out they had a pretty good grasp, but I was still a criminal. I just didn't realize that at that point.
Right. Well, I mean, you kind of got to see behind the scenes. They pulled the curtain back, and you can tell what their real capabilities were.
Right.
Sort of, right?
Absolutely. And back then, I mean, it was they were still learning a lot of this stuff. That tends to be the way it is today, right? I mean, you've got a proactive and a reactive response. And for law enforcement is very proactive these days, whereas a lot of merchants and things like that are more reactive these days. So that tends to be the problem now, is that law enforcement's gotten much, I mean, they're outstanding with the work they do now, whereas private businesses and things like that, they're not so much. They've not caught up to that curve yet. But we had a discussion about ideas about how to track criminals, if I could find their IP addresses, things like that. I said, yeah, I gave them ideas that I had. A month later, I start to work. They moved me up to Columbia, South Carolina, because that's where the field office was up there. They moved me up there, put me in a hotel, or one of these extended stay hotels, and I start to work. And my job was to go in 4 to 6 hours a day and surf these forums and find targets and start trying to come up with investigations, buy products, get information, everything else like that. Started doing that. They would bring in, like, they brought in ICE at one point. I would talk to ICE. I talked to Bank of America, a couple of prosecutors, a couple of other field offices as well to, I guess, get the idea of what a cyber criminal actually does and what he looks like and everything else. And again, they were good guys. They were good guys. I think they really, if I would have listened, if my focus would have been anything but wanting to get back with Elizabeth and secure that relationship, I think it would have ended up differently. What happened was they were recording everything I had. I was on a laptop computer hooked up to a 50-inch plasma monitor on the wall, outside line. They were in the same room, two agents usually in the same room at the same time, along with a South Carolina law enforcement officer. They were on an outside line on a desktop, and they would watch everything I did. At the same time, they were using Spectre Pro to record keystrokes. They were using Camtasia to record screenshots of what was going on. And everything went on a DVD at the end of the night. First 2 weeks, they were very diligent, and they paid attention. They asked questions, everything else. After 2 weeks of not being able to do anything except watch one guy surf forums every single minute for 4 to 6 hours a day, they got bored, and you cannot blame them for getting bored. So I started to notice that, and they started to watch things they probably shouldn't have been watching. They did what men do. They started looking at women online. I noticed that, and I'm like, at the same time, I'm like, hey, all this data that they're recording is going on a DVD. There's no way they're going to parse through that to find out what the hell I'm doing. Why not? So what I started to do was use the time I had in the offices to gather information to commit crime outside, because I was doing credit card theft, I was doing the tax return fraud, everything else. That continued for 10 months, man. I did that for 10 months during that time.
So what kind of information were you trying to gather?
What I would do was I would find contacts for prepaid debit cards. I would round up lists of names of victims, and then I would email those. I would email the victim lists along with the way the tax fraud scheme worked then, you would have a victim's name, you would use payroll software to come up with the amounts
to have credited to the card. So you would file a fake return on a victim for the debit card. The way the amount on the card would, on the return would work, it would have to match the limits on the prepaid debit card. So I didn't have a lot of time to do all that basic footwork outside of Secret Service offices because I was with Elizabeth. I didn't want her to know I was breaking the law. At the same time, I was with the Secret Service, so I had to find some way to gather the information, and that became at the Secret Service offices. So I would do the payroll software, find out the amounts and everything else. While working at the office, I would gather the victims' names and everything else. I would email those to, I think it was a Hushmail account at that point in time, and then later harvest out of the Hushmail account all the information and then file taxes. And that's what I did, was that. Just a horrible, absolutely horrible, despicable person, I'll tell you that.
Did you ever get close to being caught when you were doing that?
No. They would ask me what I was doing, and I would tell them I was making sure that if someone wanted to know how to do tax fraud, that I would have the correct figures for them and everything, and that was the only thing that was ever asked. Was that. And it helped me, because what happened was is I told them immediately about the tax return scheme that I was doing, and told them that I could use that scheme to help bring other targets in. You know, I could basically walk somebody through how to commit it, and that would build enough trust up so that the Secret Service could target that individual and then make an arrest later on. So that was that social engineering part of me. You know, I was like, okay, tell them so much, that'll distract their information away from what I'm doing, and they'll think everything's fine at that point. So, of course, that's what Idiot Here did, was that. So, yeah, that continued for the entire 10 months. So that had happened, and I was in the process of breaking up with her when this guy, while I was working at Secret Service, this guy manages to install a keylogger on the computer that I'm using in the office. And he gets Elizabeth's name.
When you say this guy, you're talking about like an external?
He's an external attacker. He's a cyber criminal, Max Butler. Max Butler was the guy. So Max Butler installs because part of my work was if anyone sent a link over or a file for me to look at it. So of course I click on everything that comes through, something I'd never done before. So I click on everything that comes through, keylogger gets installed. We didn't know what had happened. I go into work one day, and as soon as I go in, the phone starts ringing. I had a prepaid burner phone that I used at the office as well. So the burner phone that's at the office starts ringing. I pick it up, and this voice that's using the hard for hearing thing, the voice comes across saying, "Brett Johnson, I know who you are. I know who your fiance is. I know where you're living. I know that you're Gollum fun. I know everything." So I'm sitting there just, what on earth, man? And then I start, this ICQ message board pops up, and it's saying the exact same thing. So I'm like, what the devil? The Secret Service guys, they're sitting there looking at me like, what's going on? So I'm like, don't know. They think I'm doing it.
Uh-huh.
So Secret Service loads me up in the car. They think Elizabeth's at the apartment. I've moved into an apartment by this point. She's living with me. They think she's doing it. We all go to the apartment. They search the place, no computers, anything else. Finally, we come back. We start talking about it, and I'm like, don't know. But start noticing, I'm like, it's got to be a keylogger, got to be something like that. The keylogger stays on the system for 6 weeks. 6 weeks.
Undetected?
No. Well, we knew it was a keylogger.
Okay.
Or that was a thought.
Yeah.
Everyone thought it was a keylogger. I was like, we need to format. Nope. Leave it on.
Was it just like for misinformation purposes?
Well, you would think, but the way my line worked, I never talked about working for the Secret Service from that computer. So it looked like it was just strictly criminal work that was going on there, except he had found out who I actually was, is what it looked like. So I assume that part of it was to track this guy down, to do some investigation on him as well. They finally did identify him. I don't know if Max ever got charged with anything at all that happened with that. Probably not, because there were much more serious charges waiting on him. Because of that, and because of what Elizabeth had said about having sex with some other woman, we break it up at that point. And dude, right there, I go absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy. I start, it becomes every single night at a strip club for me. And I would go in with a wad of 20s. I'd hand that to the bartender. I'd tell her to bring however many kamikaze drinks that would bring. And at the same time, I'd try to hook up with whatever strippers I could. I started dating strippers exclusively. And
You know, I went through several things where I thought I was just, I've definitely hit rock bottom now, and I wouldn't hit rock bottom for a couple of years after that. But that's what happened, is I started going through the stripper mentality. I embraced the crime stuff, started drinking like a fish. Every night I would just get drunk. Sometimes I'd fall asleep in the parking lot. Sometimes somebody would have to take me home, something like that. And just felt hopeless. Denise, my sister, by that point, she had disowned me. I kept trying to call her. She wouldn't take a phone call, nothing else. So I felt like I didn't have anything. Secret Service guys, they were trying like hell. I mean, they were trying like hell to get me turned around. I think that they realized that I was on the precipice. I don't know if they knew I was breaking the law. I think they suspected it. But I think they really wanted to see me turn it around. Because, I'm a likable guy, personable. Back then I used that for criminal means, but I just didn't turn it around, man. I didn't turn it around. So that's what happened, is we broke up with Elizabeth. Shortly after that, a Royal Canadian Mounted Police operation is shut down. Washington flies in to find out what the hell I did with that, get out of that mess. Then Operation Rolling Stone comes out. And what had happened was one of my buddies, his name was Sean Mims, when my wife left me, because you don't have friends. When you're a criminal, you have associates. When my wife left me, the only person I had to talk to was Sean Mims. I had trained Sean on how to do the tax return fraud, everything else. And the dude used to call me every single day to make sure I was all right. And I told him, I was like, hey man, if I ever go missing, you know not to talk to me if I come back all of a sudden. So I go missing for 3 months. Start back to work with the Secret Service. I'm not working in the office for a week. Until one day, Sean Mims messages me over ICQ. Are you all right? And I'm like, I am, but you're not. Of course, I don't tell him that. And started an investigation on him. They identified him within 4 or 5 days. Got his IP address. He was in Los Angeles. He was using an internet cafe that had a dedicated IP. The only thing they needed to do was just go down while he was on it.
Yep.
It was easy enough to find him. Operation Rolling Stone was targeted to arrest 9 people. Sean was one of the 9. I think that date was March 17th of 2006 was that date for that operation. So they go and arrest Sean. When they arrested him, he was living in an apartment. The apartment manager knew him pretty well because Sean, renting an apartment, had done $17,000 worth of improvement in this apartment. So the apartment manager comes out during the arrest, tells the agents, hey, don't know what's going on, but last night Sean loaded up an entire U-Haul full of stuff and took it out of here. So the agents pull me out. They're like, we need you to take a polygraph test. And I'm like, I'm not taking a polygraph test. They're like, well, talk to your lawyer. So I call my lawyer. The lawyer's like, you don't have to take it, but they're going to send you to jail if you don't. So I'm like, I'll take it. They asked me 3 questions, man. 3 questions were, did I warn anyone about the investigation? Was I in contact with the press, or did I use a computer outside of the office? And over the past 2 or 3 years, I've flipped on that first question, did I warn anybody? Simply because I think it's a cooler story if I say, yeah, I warned somebody. Truth of the matter was, I didn't warn anybody at all. I was just trying to save my own skin at that point. But I did contact the press, and I was using the computers outside of the offices. So they revoked my bond, sent me back to the county jail, searched the apartment that I had, find debit cards, find cash, find stolen IDs, everything else. They let me sit in the county jail for 4 or 5 days, at which point the second in charge for the field office, his name was Jim, he comes in with the agent in charge, pulled me out of the cell, sit me down in the interrogation room, and Jim looks at me and he was like, he's got this Miranda paper in his hand. He was like, now Brett, here's the way this is going to work. Before I give this to you, I want you to know you're going to tell me every single thing you've done the past 6 years, or I'm going to make it my mission in life to screw over you and your family. Not just talking about this case. Once you get out, I will hound you the rest of your life. And he slid the Miranda paper over at me, smiles at me, and he's like, you want to talk to me now? And I looked at him and I was like, he stands up, curses me out, heads out the door. The problem was, is I was not federally indicted. I was state indicted. The state judge ruled that the Secret Service had my bond revoked improperly. He reinstates it. I walk out. No one calls the Secret Service. So what do I do? Call the stripper girlfriend that I had given $60,000 to. Her name was Kim. Tell her I need $1,000 and I'll pay her back $3,000 in 2 weeks. So she gives me $1,000 and I take off west on Interstate 20. No idea where the hell I'm going to go. End up in Dallas, walk into a prepaid debit card shop, walk out with 60 cards, and start back in tax fraud. That's basically what would happen with me right there, man. I go off, I steal about $600,000 in 4 months. Wake up one morning after I'd stolen $160,000, and I'm United States Most Wanted.
So, how'd you find out?
Max Butler again. He ran a site called cartersmarket.com. And what Max had done, for those who don't know, Max was a very paranoid person. So he had brought me in. I was working for Secret Service. He knew the Gollum Fund name because I was a friend of his. He brought me in as an admin while I was working for the Secret Service. So what happens is Secret Service knew that I was on the run. Of course, they knew I was on the run. They also knew that I had to rely at some point on this criminal network. So they decided to short-circuit that. The way they short-circuited it was they posted Brett Johnson, Most Wanted, and then they detailed the type of work that I was doing, that I was doing this certain, you know, targeting forums and everything else. Max Butler finds out about it. I go to his website that morning, and he's got my name up there, U.S. Most Wanted beside of, and he's talking about, okay. Oh, he was an admin here. Bam, 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 bam. We need to find this guy right now. Max, because he was so paranoid with everything, he was scared to death that all these other sites out there was law enforcement. So this guy, over the space of a weekend, he hacks into, basically got the credentials, of every other criminal forum online at that point, shuts them all down, sends emails to all the other members of all these other forums saying, hey, there's only one place to do business now, and that's my place. What Max didn't realize was that some of those websites he shut down were law enforcement websites.
Oh.
So he gets, yeah, they get upset about that. So of course, Max, he gets arrested after a while. I think he was arrested in San Francisco, finally. San Francisco or LA is where he was arrested. He got, 17 years, something like that? That's what he got. He stole 60 million credit card numbers. Was indicted, so this is July of 2019. He was indicted, I think, 3 months ago. Because he's in prison, he buys a cell phone in prison, uses a cell phone, so he pays $1,000 for his cell phone. The guards sell you cell phones in there. Pays $1,000 for the cell phone, uses a cell phone to get on the dark web, gets stolen credit card details on the dark web, uses stolen credit card details to fund his buddy's commissary accounts, uses one of the credit cards to buy a drone, uses the drone to have other phones delivered inside of the prison. And go out, opens up shop all of a sudden.
He's an entrepreneur.
Needless to say, they found out about that. His release date was going to be 2023. I'm guessing now 2035, 2040, something like that. But that was Max. And that's how I found out I was U.S. Most Wanted. I went to his website, and my name was on there. And I kid about it in my presentations. But, man, I saw that, and the only thing I could do was sit there and stare at it. That was it. I went to the U.S. Secret Service link, read everything. I start searching online for any type of data that's on there about me, and I just sit there staring at it. I'm like, I was in Las Vegas, and I was like, I need to leave Las Vegas today.
Yeah.
And I figured the best place I could go, I was like, okay, I need as far away from Vegas as I could get. I can go to Key West, which may be found down there, or maybe I can hide in the crowd in Orlando, Florida. So I went to Disney World. That's where I went.
Nice.
Yeah. I lasted, I think I lasted 6 weeks at Disney World.
So wait, tell me about 6 weeks at Disney World. I've heard that before, but like, what does that mean? Like 6 weeks in the Magic Kingdom, riding the Space Mountain? Or
this is what this idiot right here did. So I go to Orlando. I get a hotel room at Holiday Inn on Universal Boulevard there. I'm in the Holiday Inn. I'm looking for rental properties. So I'm wanting to rent a place, pay cash for it, and just lay low. I figure if I can lay low about a year, maybe things will die down. I've got plenty of cash. Maybe things will die down and I can bug out to Brazil, finally. That's been my goal the entire time.
Brazil.
I figure I'd go down there and set up shop again. So
interesting enough, just a quick interlude. A lot of the credit card fraud we see
Brazil,
epicenter Brazil. For it. Crazy.
Yeah, they're well educated down there in fraud. So Start looking around on Craigslist. I find this timeshare that's being built on Universal Boulevard. And there was half timeshare, half condos that were being sold. People who were buying condos would rent the condos out that were there. So I contact the guy and I'm like, I'd like to rent it for 9 months. And he's like, fine. He's like, I go through a rental property. And I was like, okay, that's fine. We'll contact the management. So I go to the management and I've got a fake ID in this guy's name of Michael Thibodeau is the guy's name. So they're like, well, you need to pay a deposit and we'll have to run credit. And I was like, well, let's say we don't want you to run credit. What do I need to do? And they're like, well, you know, we would need the money up front. And I was like, how much money would you need up front for that? So here I am. I give them like $16,000 cash right there, all in 20s. And they don't even question it. Just all in 20s. There's your money. We're good now. And they're like, yes.
What does $16,000 all in 20s look like?
It looks like a table full of $20 bills is what it looks like. So to give you an idea of how much that actually is, in a backpack that you see these kids go back and forth to high school or college or something like that, that will hold $150,000 in 20s.
All right.
Is what that, if you stack it properly. And I know because I used to take great joy in stacking $150K in a backpack and then throwing it in a bedroom. So yeah, I gave them 16 grand. Then I went to this furniture store, Modern Furniture, because I figured, oh, I may as well buy furniture while I'm here. Paid $30,000 for furniture, another $20,000 for electronics. Figured if I was going to be there for that long, I may as well be comfortable. Then I went to Disney, because it was a Florida driver's license I had. I went to Disney, bought the year pass at Disney, went to Universal, bought the year pass at Universal, and every day I went to Disney and Universal. That's what I did. So, I was clueless, man. I figured I was safe and everything else. And looking back now, there were these telltale signs that they identified me and where I was pretty quickly. So I was like one night, I had a balcony, and I noticed this woman. I had a 2000 Jeep Cherokee that I had bought. So I noticed this woman that was kind of circling around the Cherokee, and she was on her cell phone. I'm like, what the hell is that? So I walk outside. Act like I'm taking the garbage out, walk by her, and she doesn't pay me any attention. And that was probably a good indicator at that point that law enforcement knew exactly where I was. Week later, September 16th, 2006, I was used to these builders, because they were still building this entire complex, I was used to the builders coming through and knocking on doors sometimes, asking if everything was working, everything else. 10:30 in the morning, knock, knock, knock. I get up, look out the peephole, nobody's there. I'm like, what the hell, man? Open up the door, step outside, look down the hall. There's two South Carolina Secret Service guys and an Orange County deputy walking down the hall. They turn around, look at me. Me being the idiot, I look at them. Hi, guys. How are you all doing? Bobby looks at me. He's like, Brett, we're doing pretty good. How are you? And I'm like, pretty good. You want to come in? And he's like, let's put you in cuffs first. I'm like, I figured. So they put me in cuffs. Take me in, sit me down on the sofa. Bobby looks at me and he's like, you got anything in here? And I was like, well, there's $150,000 cash in the bedroom. And he was like, seriously?
I'm like, there's in a Mickey Mouse backpack.
In a backpack. And he was like, seriously? And I'm like, seriously, there's $150,000. And then I looked at him and I was like, plus there's an AK-47 in there. And he was like, what? I'm like, I'm just kidding. So he was like, you better not have any weapons, Johnson. I'm like, no, I don't do weapons, man. So, sat there and they processed me through and they brought the seizure papers with them, of course.
Did they tell you how they found you?
They did not. I assume that what had happened was when I was running Shadow Crew, one of the things we used to like try to teach people, because we'd read all these books and accounts and everything else of how you should go on the run. You know, you should cut off all ties with family and friends. You should go someplace you've never been before. You should not practice the same habits you had practiced before, everything else. Well, I had followed all of that except family contact. That's what I'd done. I couldn't do that. I preached it, but I couldn't follow through with it. So I had sent my mom a cell phone and $3,500 cash by FedEx. I figured they were intercepting the USPS mail, so I could do it by FedEx. So I figured that's how they contacted me at that point. And one of the other guys that on the investigation when I worked with them, Daniel Rigmaiden, I had trained him on how to do tax ID fraud. They had found him using, back then it was called Triggerfish, now it's Stingray. They had found him by using the Triggerfish device. I figured they may have done that same thing with me, something like that. Because the night before I was arrested, I had that cell phone
It was in a Vegas area code, and I get a phone call, and I'm like, "What the hell, man?" So I answer it, and on the other end of the line is someone that says they're from Papa John's Pizza.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm like, "No, I didn't order a pizza." So I thought that was very funny, but I'm like, "I'm okay, I believe."
Well, when I was in the FBI, a lot of the ruse calls that I would make to people just to confirm
pizza?
I was always like Little Caesars or Papa John's.
Of course.
It's the first thing I thought of.
And I had actually seen them do that to guys when I was working with in the offices. They had done that pizza stuff, man. But
I mean, that's not in any official manuals. I don't know. It's just a trend. So in case anybody listening get calls from random pizza people.
There you go. It may be.
Go.
They put me in the Orange County jail. I was there for, I don't know, six or seven weeks. And that's during that point in time I fabricated the drug thing that I had this meth guy. His name was Yeti because he had long white hair and a long white beard. Everyone called him Yeti. He took me under his wing. Because I guess he realized that I was just a completely lost soul behind bars. He looks at me one day and he's like, "You know, the only time you get off in federal prison is the drug program." And I'm like, "No, I didn't know that, but I don't use drugs." And he was like, "You can find a drug problem, can't you?" And I'm like, I looked at him and I'm like, "I can find a drug problem." So I start telling everybody that would listen, I'm on coke.
Good old
and
Yeti.
Alcohol. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got the drug program and that was it, man. But that was the story there. It bugs me these days that I wrote a 17-page letter to the judge blaming the Secret Service for every single thing I could possibly blame them for. You know, it's their fault. I would have never done it. I'm addicted to drugs. It bothers me these days that, you know, I look back and it bugs me that people tried to help me. And I just wouldn't take it, you know. It's a lot of guilt there, man, you know.
Yeah.
And these two guys, I mean, they lost their jobs. They lost their jobs. And nobody says it's because of me, but they didn't work much longer after my case for the Secret Service. It really bothers me. The number of victims that I had weren't just people that I stole money from, but it was law enforcement. It was this girl, Elizabeth, because I certainly didn't make her life any better. You know, and I don't know what to do about that. You know, I don't think you can make amends for anything like that, you know?
Yeah, no, that's tough.
Yeah. So that's what I wanted to talk about today was that. You got any questions about any of that crap?
Oh, man. No, I mean, this series that you're doing is extremely interesting because I think, you know, as you tell your story in the minute detail that you're currently doing it, I'm sure you're kind of stumbling upon it. Things and discovering things about yourself maybe or how you're actually dealing with it now.
It's killing me.
Before.
I didn't think it was going to have that type of effect. My agent, so I've got a talent agent. He had mentioned this to me about doing a podcast about my story and they could use that for the book or the TV series as kind of a basis for that. He had mentioned that, I don't know, 6 or 7 months ago. And I did not expect it to have the effect that it's had on me. I'm going through depression. I'm going through guilt. I'm questioning relationships. I'm just upset about the life that I led before I'm doing what I'm doing now. I'm very retrospective about, you know, the wasted time. I was a criminal for over 40 years, Aaron. 40 years. I mean, what does that say about a human being that the only thing they did was figure out how to get one over or steal from people? And I don't think there's any making amends for that. I really don't think there is. I think that, you know, I try to do things right now, but when all is said and done, I'm not sure you can ever get forgiven for that much damage.
Well, I certainly understand how you feel. In my mind, I don't see it as a scale, right?
Right.
You know, I look at my life, I see all the bad stuff I've done, I see all the good stuff I've done, and I think by the end of my life here, the scales need to be tipped a little bit more on the good side, right? But I really think that's the wrong way to think about it.
Yeah.
I think what you're doing now is going above and beyond what most people do in their average lives as far as good that they're doing. This podcast is extremely important, because I'm learning that, you know, you think criminals are bad or because they're just bad people, but they're not bad people. Like, you were never a bad person. I could obviously tell that there's probably an element there in your, I don't know if it stems from your childhood or from your upbringing, but there's this need for being loved, or that just might be an element to that.
And, yeah, it might be.
And couple on top of that, you're extremely clever.
Where is that?
So,
where is that?
So you leverage your cleverness and your natural ability to see a situation, right? You look at a house and it's big door, and on that big door there's a huge lock. And most people think, I'm not getting to that, so they leave. But you're clever enough. You look around the corner, I'm like, the window's open. And you go right in, right?
Let's go on in.
That's coupled with that. And plus, you're extremely talented. So I think you're on the right path. I think what you're doing is extremely valuable, not only for organizations to help combat fraud, but on a personal level with everyone you interact with.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I want to thank you for sitting down and talking with me about this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Anglerfish. I appreciate it. If you like it, please subscribe and drop me a line saying hello. Hello is always good. You can reach me direct at brettjohnson@anglerfish.com. That's Brett, B-R-E-T-T, Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N, at anglerfish, A-N-G-L-E-R-P-H-I-S-H.com. Please tell your friends about us, rate and review the Anglerfish podcast wherever you can. In the next few weeks, we'll be launching Season 2 of Anglerfish, which will examine the darkest corners of our online lives and what you need to do to remain safe. Please email me questions, comments, concerns, personal stories, and any topics you might like to hear discussed. That's brettjohnson@anglerfish.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Brett Johnson. Stay safe, stay secure, and stay vigilant.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.